Hello, this is Aaron, and welcome back to the podcast. This week, I'm going to go back to the topic of elites and look at what we can learn about elite selection from looking at the Mormon Church. It's no surprise that religion is in decline in the United States, but there is an exception, the Mormons. The Mormons are growing. They're actually booming. Not only that, they have great family formation statistics in an era when the overall stats are bad. They get married. They have kids, often lots of kids, right? They tend to stay married. Not that divorce is, you know, impossible there, but they seem to have pretty solid families. Just look at a place like Utah, which I believe has the highest birth rate in the country. They also have very high-functioning communities overall. Again, look at Utah. It's like a throwback to what America used to be back in the day. The Mormons also have great aesthetics. I mentioned that all these Mormon mommy bloggers out there, a huge percentage of the mommy bloggers tend to be Mormons. Or Kinfolk Magazine, if you're familiar with that, was also Mormon. You know, when I lived in New York City, I lived right up the street from the Mormon temple, and I would sometimes see these Mormon families walking down Columbus Avenue towards the temple, and you could spot them blocks away. They just had such this incredible, perfect look about them. Like, this can't be true. And then they've got things like the Mormon Tabernacle Choir, the beautiful temples that they often build. The Mormon Temple here in Indianapolis is a fantastic structure. And then they've been very financially successful. They have apparently a $100 billion hedge fund that the church manages. Now, the Mormons did almost go bankrupt a couple of times. So they have gone through brushes with financial disaster. Right now, incredibly financially successful as a church. And you look at these guys and like, what are they doing right? And I would suggest that their overperformance is in part a result of a high-quality elite selection process. Now, I'm going to talk about the Mormon Church using essentially Wikipedia-tier knowledge about it. I'm not going to claim to be a deep expert on the Mormon Church. I did some reading preparing for this, and I know I have at least one LDS listener on here because I've heard from him before, so I'm sure that I will get an email with many, many, many details that I got wrong, but the key is just look at the bigger picture and think about it. And I really got interested in this when I read, maybe during his presidential campaign, that Mitt Romney had spent several years as a Mormon bishop. Now, as it turns out, a bishop in the Mormon Church is more like a parish priest than a bishop in the Catholic Church. But still, the idea that he's a parish priest, and he was the president of something I think they call it a stake, which is the equivalent of a diocese in the Mormon Church. So he was essentially the head of the diocese, too. And he's doing this at the same time that he's running Bain Capital. So he's running Bain Capital by day, and on the weekends, he is the volunteer, unpaid parish priest slash bishop of his local Mormon church. Like, man, that's kind of curious. How did they get this high wattage, obviously very impressive person to serve in that position? And what I discovered is that the Mormons actually do this strategically. They do a very good job of screening for, identifying, selecting, and developing and promoting good, high-quality leaders into their church. And, you know, we can see this in the people who've reached the top of it. The Mormon Church is run by a three-man office of the First Presidency, and then there's also another body, I think, called the Quorum of the 12 Apostles, which is like, you know, kind of a secondary body there. And I'm just going to read some of the people who occupy these positions and tell you just a tiny bit about them. You can look them all up on Wikipedia if you want to know more. And I'm not going to go through them all. This is taken from an article. The actual people who occupy these roles is taken from a 2018 article. So maybe there's been some changes, but the point is not the who, but just to give you a sense of who they are. So the president of the Mormon Church is a guy named Russell M. Nelson. And Nelson was a top surgeon with a long and illustrious career. He actually helped develop the heart-lung machine back in the 50s, I believe. The first counselor to the president, and this presidency, first presidency that runs it, is a guy named Dallin Oaks. He went to the University of Chicago Law School. He worked for big law at Kirkland & Ellis, and he served on the Utah Supreme Court. The second counselor is a guy named Henry Eyring. I think that's how you pronounce it, E-Y-R-I-N-G. He got a PhD from Harvard and went on to teach at Stanford and MIT. And then moving on to this, Quorum of the 12 Apostles, this elder named Jeffrey Holland, he's the former president of Brigham Young University. Now, not all of these guys are equally as illustrious, but if you look at them, you realize, like, man, they have managed to put some pretty high wattage people into leadership positions in that church. Maybe there's a reason that they're successful. And what you see is all these guys are old. The Mormon church sort of runs on a longevity and seniority system. Their rank within this quorum and within the presidency is seniority-based. So there really is a gerontocracy there. And, you know, I've critiqued gerontocracy elsewhere, and I think that it really has caused them problems in the past. I think there have been situations where the president of the Mormon Church has become essentially incapacitated through disease or dementia, and it's really caused problems for them. So there are some downsides to this gerontocracy, but they have had people who've been around a long time, have been proven over many, many, many years. So there's no chance, very little chance, very hard chance, that there's going to be any interest. So some new person is going to come in, and I'm going to penetrate the leadership, and I'm going to change this. And I mean, if you want to do that, you have to be all in for a very long time to even think about getting close to the leadership of that place. So that's a good thing. And then they operate at least nominally on the basis of consensus, meaning unanimous consent. Now, how it really works, I don't know. But, you know, they don't have this necessarily majority voting approach. In theory, there's a consensus-based approach among the senior leadership. So what we see is they have really identified very high caliber, high talent, proven people to be in those leadership, top leadership positions in the church. And this is something that we see at all levels of the organization. Again, they screen, they identify, they develop, and they promote, you know, high potential and high demonstrated capacity to lead, and for people who are all in on what they're doing as a church. One thing that they do, I believe this starts at a pretty young age, is they seem to surveil their members. That's probably not the term that they would use, but my impression is if you are a Mormon, you in essence have something resembling a social credit score, like Chinese-style social credit score. So they are looking. Do you attend services every week? Did you do your mission work? Do you tithe? Right? Are you serving in the callings that they've given you, which we'll talk about in a minute? You know, are you, you know, on board with all the things that they want you to be? Are you demonstrating high capability and, you know, accomplishment in your secular career? So they're looking at this stuff and say, okay, what are these people doing? And they're looking at that. And then as they find out who you are and see your capabilities and get to know you a little bit, they assign you to what are called callings. So a calling is basically your job in the Mormon church. And these callings are unpaid. One thing that's very unique about the Mormon church, maybe we'll talk more about this, is they don't have paid clergy, paid ministry. So yes, they do have some people who get paid, but for the most part, they rely on unpaid lay volunteers to do all the work. But the key is you're not truly a volunteer in the sense that we would think of a volunteer in the Christian church. The Mormon leadership at all these levels looks at the talent pool that they have, the people under them, and they say, this guy would probably be a good fit here. We have a need. Who would be good to fill that need? That's this guy. It's this person. So they put that person in there, and that person is now the unpaid, you know, provider of that task for potentially years. I mean, Mitt Romney served as a bishop for several years in the Mormon church. And here's the key. They tell you what you're going to do. You don't necessarily tell them what you want to do. Think about the mission. One of the key callings is the mission trip that you do. Young Mormon men, you know, they don't have to do it, but they're expected to do it. And it's certainly going to count against you if you don't do it. They're expected to do 2 years of mission work for the Mormon church. They don't get to pick where they serve. You know, they are assigned to a mission. They have to be willing to serve anywhere in the world. They pick what you do. And so kind of what this does is it does a few things. One, it lets them match people with positions that they think are a good fit for them. So it's a mix of need and capabilities and attributes. It's not like, you know, they're just sticking people in these roles. They're looking and saying, okay, who would be a good person to put in this role? And it also lets them check for skin in the game. You know, you have to be willing to do kind of what they want and serve the needs that are there, not just follow your own interest, you know, your own preferences, your own guidelines. Secondly, it lets them say, hey, this guy's pretty good. Let's get him exposure here. Let's get him exposure here. Let's get him exposure here. Sort of like, you know, corporations, they have these, you know, high-performing people coming up through the ranks often go through kind of executive rotations. You spend some time in marketing, you spend some time in finance, you spend some time in production, and that's because people that they think are, you know, possible C-suite type people, top people, they want them to get exposure to various aspects of the business and know how a little bit about how every part of the business works. And I gather that the Mormons do some of that. It's like, this guy is really good, so we're going to make sure he gets exposure here, gets exposure there, and he's building skills, you know, knowledge of the system, etc. And so over time, you move up as you demonstrate competence and as you demonstrate that you are in skin in the game, totally committed to the Mormon church, you know, you move up through the ranks. And obviously relying on unpaid people, often, it's probably one reason why they've got so much money. They're not paying a huge amount of cash out in salaries to all these people. I don't know if this is totally true, but, you know, I was told that, you know, they never borrow money. They, when they build something, they pay cash for it. It's like, okay, we're going to save up our money through tithes and we're going to pay cash for that temple. Think about that. Kind of crazy. But when you don't have any salaries, that works. So ultimately here, what you see, right, is that the Mormon church is led by a group of very top people, right? And because they've made it that way. They say Mitt. Now Mitt, of course, his dad was governor of the state of Michigan. You know, so I'm sure that there are some favoritism. I'm not saying none of that stuff occurs. But, you know, do you think Mitt Romney really wanted to be the volunteer parish priest of his ward or whatever they call it in church? Well, I'm like, I'm running this hedge fund here, guys. Why don't you, you know, can't you see I'm busy? I mean, can you imagine like that happening to, you know, a business executive in a Christian church that, you know, one day the leadership of the church comes to him and says, you're going to be the next pastor of this church for several years. He'd be like, what are you even talking about here? So this is just a completely different way of thinking about elite selection. It is a strong process because you have to have demonstrated that you're all in on Mormonism. You have to have skin in the game. And not just to get to a high position, you have to do that over a course of decades, right, to really reach the top. And you have to have demonstrated competence. And they're bringing in people with, like, real skills to do these things. And I think it's interesting to contrast this with how Christian churches select elites. How do we select our elites? Now, I'm not going to suggest here, what I'm not saying, I want to be very clear, what I'm not saying is that we should imitate the Mormon system. Among other things, we have ecclesiastical and theological reasons for the way that we select elites, but I think it's worth considering. How do we select the people who, you know, make the machine go in a Christian church? Well, I've said before that Protestant churches, the elders or the deacons or whatever they're called in your church, the people who kind of are the board of directors, the people who run the thing, tend to be, you know, often the richest dudes in the church because giving follows the Pareto distribution, 80-20. Those guys are probably, you know, financing a lot of it. It just happens to happen. Typically, the richest guys in the church tend to end up on that board. And you know what? Wealth, to some extent, is a proxy for talent in many cases. Not all talent, not all cases. I might say that's a totaling, but heuristically, yeah, if this person is an executive or this person is a surgeon or this person, you know, is a big developer or, you know, this person is a scientist and they've made a lot of money, well, they're probably also pretty talented. So in my experience, this group of people actually does tend to be pretty talented. Now, I did a podcast a while back I called The Composition of Bodies, where I said you have to look at the compositions of things like your board of elders and say, what is the profile of person on it? Because yes, it might be, you know, from a talent perspective, even from a character perspective, selecting these people may be good, but various people may be more subject to secular pressures than others. And if you have all people who are, say, corporate executives who are under tremendous vulnerability, exposed to tremendous vulnerability to secular pressure, they may not make all of the decisions, you know, that you might want them to make or that they might make. You want to have, I think, some diversity in ways that may be not traditionally considered in terms of like how they make their money and the amount of exposure they have to the world at large. But in general, I think selects for pretty competent people. I also think, you know, when a Protestant church is selecting a new minister, a new pastor, they tend to go through a selection process. You know, they post it, they have candidates apply, they interview, they often bring them in for sample sermons. You know, they're checking them out, they're checking their references. They may even have a consultant to help them through the process. So they are, you know, trying to find the best person that they can to fill that role. That's pretty good that you're going through that process. What I find interesting is that Christians, however, rely on essentially a self-selected ministerial pool. So in the Christian church, we've always had this idea of calling, different from the Mormon idea of calling, right? It's the idea that God has called me into something. God has called me into the ministry. And you'll hear that. I feel that God is calling me into the ministry. I think God is calling me to become a priest. He's calling me to become this. And we see that back in the New Testament, right? Jesus called his disciples. He said, you know, you follow me. Come with me. I'm picking you guys. And it's also the case that Jesus picked people who, by the standards of the day, were not especially high-performing individuals. And in fact, we see that, you know, prior to Pentecost, you know, prior to his, you know, prior to the ascension, basically, these guys are basically kind of buffoons. They're no good. They're constantly, like, fighting with each other. They're constantly trying to, you know, angle for position. They have a little faith. They don't really know what's going on. You know, really, essentially, after the ascension, they're all in the upper room praying together, and then Pentecost happens, and it's a big transformation. But if you were looking at an elite selection process modeled on the Mormons, you know, Jesus would not have picked these guys. Okay, so we have that kind of background there. You know, but I point out, you know, God did also call and have, you know, genuine high-caliber talent that the world would recognize. So people like Joseph Arimathea was a follower. I think Nicodemus ended up being a follower. And of course, most famously, Paul. You know, Paul was truly an elite, right? A Pharisee of Pharisees, kind of an apprentice to Gamaliel, who was on the Sanhedrin, the Jewish High Council. And I don't think it's any surprise that Paul, you know, ended up being essentially the highest performing guy in terms of like starting all these churches going out. You know, God did pick, you know, fishermen and lowly people, but he also picked some, you know, traditional elites as well, we might say. But I think the key is, you know, there is this idea, you know, you didn't choose me, I chose you, and that, hey, you know, the God does not judge, Jesus does not judge the way that the world judges. You know, he sees into the heart, he sees other things. So it's important to think about that and not just say, oh, well, let's just go get the, you know, our hedge fund managers and put them in charge. Not saying that, just drawing a contrast and look at what we got. And but it is essentially an entirely self-selected process. You know, one time, and this really struck me because it's the only time this has ever happened, I got together with a pastor for lunch. He just looked at me and said, Aaron, you should go to seminary and become a pastor. I'm like, wow, interesting you say that. You should do that. You should become a pastor. And you know, obviously I haven't done that. Well, you know, I'm old, this, that. I mean, you know, maybe I should have done that. I don't know. I'm saying I shouldn't have done that. But it's interesting. He said, you should become a pastor. And I know another guy that happened to, John Moody, who I just had on the podcast. We just talked about, you know, resistance is fertile and homesteading. Man, that podcast is already like getting a bunch of views. That guy is popular. People love to hear him talk. But the key is, you know, he went to Southern Baptist Theological Seminary because, you know, he became a Christian in college and the church he was attending. They said, you know, John, you should go to seminary. You should be in the ministry. My experience, that's not the norm. It's pretty rare for people to look at you and say, hey, you know what? You should think about going into the ministry. Instead, it's essentially a self-discerned call. you know, oh, I feel like I should go to seminary. It's often very young people who decide to do it. And, you know, maybe they're too young. I mean, so I think we end up with a pool of people, right, who went to seminary, and our, you know, our ministerial pool is a lot of people who essentially have no experience of life in the real world. They've essentially been in professionalized religion of some sort their entire, essentially, adult lives. You know, they go to the Christian college, and they go to seminary, they become a youth minister or a campus minister, and, you know, and then they end up moving up. And a lot of people end up leaving the ministry. But, you know, I gather it's somewhat rarer to see, okay, now I'm 30, I'm 40, I've had some experience of life, now I'm going into the ministry. And again, it's a little different if you're Catholic when you have to take a vow of celibacy. So, you know, if you don't go into the ministry in your 20s, a good chance you're going to get married, and that's going to take you out of consideration here. I'm thinking mostly in the Protestant world. But essentially, we have people who, very young, say, God's calling me to ministry, they go to seminary, et cetera. And there seems to be very little vetting or pushback on that when people say they want to go to seminary, because these seminaries are basically businesses. Yes, they may be nonprofits. They need money like everybody else. So, you know, the more people who want to go to seminary, the better. And so I think what we do end up with is a ministerial class of people who do not have a tremendous amount of experience in the real world. Just what I would say. When it look at the administrative roles of a church, you know, who does the non-ordained work in the church, it tends to be made up of, you know, volunteers. There's a lot of volunteers. And the people who are hired as staff at church, often it's people kind of in their congregation who kind of need a job. Hey, this person needs a job, and so we're going to hire him or her part-time to do X. That's very common. I've seen that across multiple churches, multiple denominations. Not saying that's a bad thing. You know, it's good. We do have a lot of people do a lot of unpaid labor in the Christian church, and I think it's a good thing that if you have people in need, hey, maybe we could give them some job as a bridge. We need it done. They can do it. It helps. Not saying that's all bad. I do think, though, that the people who end up working in the administrations of our churches are not necessarily the people that, you know, we would, if we took a step back and say, what is the person we would love to have doing this job? We don't end up with those people, right? It's whoever steps up and volunteers. And, you know, sometimes people volunteer because they've got like some need in their life, you know, and they're looking to, you know, find meaning or something through that. I mean, I see people who kind of do that and have done that. And I'm saying that's all volunteers. Again, I'm not saying it's everybody, but there's some. And so I think a lot of times, like, man, is this like the talent pool that we would like to have running our churches? I think it's like very low selectivity. Whoever shows up and volunteers and, you know, and then it's kind of like, you know, maybe who needs a job. So we're not saying, okay, who are the people in our congregation we would like to be filling this role? And let's go tap them on the shoulder and recruit them in. Now, I'm sure that does happen some, but that seems to not be the norm. There seems to be, to some extent, who wants to do this? And in fact, you often see that in the church bulletin on Sunday. Hey, we're looking for volunteers to do X. And again, it's often a short term. Hey, we need people to, you know, pack up all these Christmas boxes that we, you know, bought for our low-income kids. Nothing wrong with that. It's like, it is. It's like total volunteer way that we staff. And no surprise, I think we always end up, you know, not exactly, you know, being run by the highest talent people, and often a lot of administrative issues and other things. So I think that's something to look at. Like, man, how do we select people for these administrative roles? And how do we kind of look at this ministerial pool? You know, I would say probably much more, you know, we should be encouraging people in the Protestant world to get a little experience of life first, to, you know, make sure that they've discerned their true calling before they just say, I'm going into the ministry. Now that I'm 23, I graduated from college, I'm getting ready to go to seminary here. Or I just, you know, converted and now I feel called to ministry, which often seems to happen, like relatively recent converts decide to go into ministry. Maybe that's not the thing. Maybe we should, you know, make your calling sure by getting a little more experience out there in the world. Let's try some other things. Just make sure this is really the thing for me. And maybe we could think about, hey, how do we make sure we've got our highest capacity people filling some of these lay roles that they should have? Now, I will kind of wrap up with a positive thing about the way some Christian denominations select elites. I think if you look at the Episcopal denominations, if you look at the Roman Catholic Church, if you look at Eastern Orthodox Church, becoming a bishop or making it to a very high-ranking position in that those hierarchies does somewhat operate a little Mormon-like in the sense that, you know, it takes a very long time to work your way up through the hierarchy. You're not going to become Pope overnight. And if you want to get to a high level, you really have to have some real demonstrated competence in things like theology, et cetera. So what you find out is a lot of these guys essentially have equivalents of like PhD in theology, philosophy. And every pope speaks like seven languages, right? These guys have learned a whole bunch of languages. That right there is a capability, particularly if you're running a global church. Yeah, you really need to have that. So I think they've got a situation where, yes, there's a very, very, very long path. So you have to be all in over a long period of time. And, you know, you have to develop real skills of a sort along the way. And so, again, I would not suggest that we change what we are doing to mimic the Mormons. Not saying that. I do look at the Mormons and say, why are they so successful? One reason is their elite selection process. And are there lessons or things that we could think about in terms of our elite selection process that maybe we could do differently? You know, maybe we should be also more telling people, hey, you seem to have some of the characteristics. You have the character, you have the aptitude to potentially be in ministry. You should think about going to seminary and becoming a pastor. You know, I don't think we do that too often. Maybe it's something we should do. Again, something to think about. If you want to read more about the Mormon Church, a very interesting case story, very interesting religion. This is an American religion born on American soil and just really interesting so much about it. So there's plenty of reading out there if you're interested. And I'm going to post this up today. By the way, this is Tuesday. I'm recording it on Tuesday. I usually record on Tuesday, put it up on Wednesday. But again, I'm trying to migrate more towards Mondays for kind of my monologue podcast because I do the interviews, tend to do the interviews Tuesday through Thursday. That tends to be when I schedule it. So I've got interview tomorrow coming up. You won't want to miss it, by the way, with Michael Foster and Non Tennant about their It's Good to Be a Man project. It's sure to be a lot of fireworks on that. So since I don't want to be dropping too many podcasts on the same days, I'm going to try to move towards Mondays. So next week is Thanksgiving. So maybe I'll put on Tuesday this week, and next week we'll drop a Thanksgiving Day podcast on Monday, and then we'll try to keep it on the Monday schedule. So again, thank you all for listening, and I'll talk to you next week.